part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
All right, shall we begin our little chat?
Let's do it.
Our little conversation.
Sure.
Let me just say right off the bat that I am Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I have two very special guests on the line. I have David Acampo. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did, Acampo, yes.
Nailed it, Acampo. And Chris Anderson.
That's right.
And I always like to say off the bat when people are doing crowdfunding, kickstarting things, that you are both doing a Kickstarter and the name of the project is Spectral and it says A Showcase of Fear in the preview that I have, which I love, A Showcase of Fear. So why don't I just get started off by asking either one of you or both of you, however you want to juggle it, the elevator pitch for what is Spectral? Why should people go on a Kickstarter, search for Spectral, and throw their money at it? Because I liked it. I read it. I've read, or at least the preview that I had that had the complete pages that I was able to read. This is very cool, very cool project. Who would like to lead with letting people know? I mean, obviously it's a horror book, right? But what is special about Spectral?
Take it away, Dave.
Yeah. Basically, this is an anthology book all by Chris and myself.
Yeah.
But it is a bunch of short, spooky stories that come from the same place as series like Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow or Tales from the Dark Side, The Twilight Zone, the more supernatural variations on that show. And so for us, it was a way to make something ourselves. This, I'm going out of the elevator pitch a little bit and just say behind the scenes, this was a way for Chris and I to kind of just make comics that we wanted to make. It began with one short story, which I had just finished DC Writers Talent Work or DC Talent Development Workshop, the Writers Workshop that Scott Snyder was teaching. And I was learning all about, you know, I was doing a lot of superhero stuff, big rising tension, big spectacular action. And I wanted sort of a shortcut from, not a shortcut, but I wanted to do something that just felt like me. And so I wrote this short horror pitch to Chris and I said, this is like a 12-page comic that we could sell ourselves at conventions. And so he was like, yeah, let's do it. Cause we had been going to various conventions and stuff with our larger works. And so he was into it and we decided to really do something special where I wanted to write something where almost every page felt like a piece of art that you could hang on your wall. And so Chris dove into that and then we kind of decided to scale it back. So all these stories are black and white with a single color for each individual story that brings out the fear or the horror in that particular story. So the first one we did was called Devil Skin, about a young man in the, I think it's 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
It's two time periods. It's like in the 50s and then I'm telling a story about older days. And it's about a young kid who's being bullied who finds a dead body with a devil's costume on it. One of those creepy old timey devil costumes, if you've ever seen them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we only put that devil costume whenever it appears on screen in red. Everything else is black and white. I said on screen, but you guys know what I mean, on page. And I think that really made something to me that felt very comics centric, very focused, and something that we could do. And so we ended up making six of those and decided with Spectral to put them all together with a framing sequence that is a new thing that no one's seen yet. Aside from the preview pages that you've seen.
Yeah.
And we, you know, because we wanted to make the book kind of recontextualize all those stories and add a little something to that. So, you know, on Kickstarter, if you go and you back it, you're getting Chris and I, our stories told our way, trying to make the best package possible that the kind of thing we would want to back on Kickstarter.
Sure.
And then we tried to create a bunch of cool things around that, you know, to add to the Kickstarter, which we'll talk about later. But sure. But that's kind of the core of it.
Sure, sure. So let me quickly just jump in and ask a quick, did you say Zack Snyder was teaching something?
Oh, Scott Snyder.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, wait, no.
If Scott. I did, I misspoke. I apologize.
No. I was just like, wait, he's teaching? Okay. I don't want Hollywood coming after me, but I had to wrap my brain around that. Well, the what is it? The framing sequence, I guess that you would call it, right? Mm-hmm. That is sort of like, I was thinking of how to sort of, verbalize what it is. And to me, it was very much like the Muppet Show meets like Tales from the Crypt, right? Because you've got like puppets, right? It's like a puppet show. That's sort of it's a traveling puppet show or like an old timey thing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that sort of came about because we needed a way to kind of make connect all of these stories together. And there wasn't really a through line in the stories themselves. So I had just gotten done working on Creepshow. And we're both big EC Comics fans, Tales from the Crypt and all that stuff. And so we wanted to kind of have a throwback to that. And we sort of needed to have some sort of host. And a friend of mine that I worked with when I was in high school, he became a puppet maker and was making these really cool, like Masters of the Universe and like Garbage Pail Kids spinoffs, but also his own like Vikings, and he makes these goblin puppets that are really awesome. Anyway, he decided that he wanted to make some puppets based off of our one-shot horror stories.
Nice.
And so they were really, really cool. And so we were like, well, what if we make the host like a puppeteer that goes around in his creepy old wagon and tells these stories to, you know, kids as he travels through town. And Dave was like, you know, let's make it sort of timeless, a timeless time when we see the kids. You can't really tell what you know, era they're from or whatever. So we were able to connect all of the stories kind of that way.
Sure.
And so, you know, like Dave and I like to say, this book, because, you know, Andy made the puppets based off of my designs, and now there's puppets that you can actually get with the Kickstarter, and you know, the host became this, you know, puppeteer, and so that this project sort of kind of just naturally evolved from circumstance and kind of became sentient in a way and told us like, this is what I am going to be, you know, we're working our way through the spectrum. And, you know, ghosts are called spectrals. And so let's call this book Spectral, because it deals with spectrum and ghosts. And we've got this puppeteer because someone made puppets for it. And, you know, it just sort of happened. And so we knew that we needed to, you know, kickstart this thing and get this thing out into the world, or possibly be cursed for the rest of our lives.
Well, no, we should say the gentleman's name who designed the puppets is Andrew Jensen, correct?
Yeah, yep, yes. And Andy Jensen, yep, and Son of Jen Puppets is the name of his company. Look him up. He's cool. You know, Facebook and Instagram and all that fun stuff. He makes some really, really cool stuff. You can't see me right now, but I do have a Skeletor puppet that he made right behind my head.
Yeah, I can see it, but not everyone else can see
it. Right,
it's very cool looking. I mentioned it when we first got onto this chat. So yeah,
they're super awesome. So he made four of the puppets out of the six. He couldn't source the material to actually make the final two, unfortunately, but he's only going to make those four.
Okay.
So for the Muppet style puppets. Now these are like stuffed Muppet style puppets. However, he also made four hand puppets that, you know, if say you wanted the witch, and somebody else already got the witch of the hand puppet, that's fine. He can make as many of those as you want. But he only made four of these puppets. Now the witch and the wolf are gone. So the only ones left are the devil and the creep from our dollhouse story, which actually in my opinion, are the two coolest puppets. So I'm not sure why they're still available. And if you're listening, I'd jump on it now.
Yeah. Honestly, part of the reason is because Chris has said I'm not allowed to buy the devil puppet because I've been very tempted. But he's absolutely right. Like, when we went into the Kickstarter, we're like, what are the coolest things we can do? And we had Andy right there with these puppets. And we're like, would he allow us to sell those puppets, you know, with him as part of this Kickstarter? Because how cool if we have this puppet show framing sequence, and then he's got the actual puppets depicted in the puppet show are puppets that you can own. Only one of a kind of each of these four. And then we worked with Andy to come up with that glove puppet idea, which is a simpler puppet. And so there are four to choose from, but we have a bigger limit set there. So you can, I think there are still some available there. But Chris is right that the devil and the creep are the only two left of the one of a kind Muppet puppets, which to me just, it's one of those things where when we thought about it, we're like, what kind of things do you like in a Kickstarter? We like that extra stuff. We like unique, bespoke, custom items that makes you feel like you're getting something great. Now, the crown jewel is still the book, right? Like, if we put all our love into that. But how cool is it that you can own a piece of something that's part of our creative process, frankly, at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Those puppets turned around and became part of the story. So, I mean, it's like having a prop from a movie or something in a way.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I love it.
So that's cool. So if you contribute at a certain level, you get one of these puppets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly.
Right.
Oh, I was not aware of that. That's a pretty awesome, like, get.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like it. That's awesome. So, I mean, who, as far as I know, did David, were you doing the writing and Chris was doing the illustrating, or did you both like interchange on like different? I mean, the style seems pretty consistent as far as the artwork is concerned. Is that all you, Chris, or am I mistaken?
The artwork is all me.
Yeah. Then David, did you do the writing?
Dave had input into the art too. I mean, but you know, I did all the pen to paper.
Gotcha.
There's a reason that we, the two of us, we tend to put like just our names, like created by on our comics, because I think that, you know, to say that I created the stories isn't accurate, because Chris is as much a storyteller, you know, on that panel-to-panel sequencing as I am.
Sure.
So the way it works between us is actually kind of interesting. I come up with the story. I write a script. Mm-hmm. It can often be somewhat loose. Chris goes and draws it. I will have input, as he said, on, you know, what, how it's flowing and everything like that. And then he'll, in most of the stories, he did the color. And then it comes back to me, and I actually do the lettering, and then I actually do the book design part two.
Gotcha.
So what's interesting there is that for me, the lettering allows me to rewrite stuff based on what Chris has drawn. And so I think to me that we become that duo where we're kind of a seamless team, where we're making the best possible product, because we're not, nobody's like overriding the other person.
Yeah.
You know, we're sort of working off of each other. And then there's even one story in there, I think Dollhouse, where I said, I got an iPad, I want to try coloring this, and I did the orange colors on that one.
Oh, cool.
And so that was fun. So we experiment back and forth, but most of the art, the pen and ink on the paper, that's all Chris, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even that way. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean.
I was just gonna say I love the artwork and the brushwork. I mean, is this traditional media that you're working in? Or are you working in digitally? I mean, it looks like brush to me.
It's brush. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, it's brush and pen. The interesting thing about this is, we sort of started doing these stories over the course of about 5 years, and each story we kind of took a different tone, and I tried to do a little something different visually with them, like devil skin. I did like an ink wash.
Yeah.
And Wolf Moon, we did kind of borderless, so it's a little bit more of like a fever dream.
Mm.
Dollhouse we did during the pandemic, and so we decided to release it as an Instagram comic.
Yeah.
So it was all single squares. So I didn't even, there's not even a page, you know, for that with all of the things on it. So it worked out when we went and printed it to be able to do a 6-panel grid with all the squares. And then Dave had the idea, since it's Dollhouse, to kind of put these like photo book corner tabs on all of them. So it makes it feel like you're, you know, reading somebody's photo book.
Yeah, it's meant to look like a photo album. Exactly.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, so we really kind of experimented with the art and creating a different tone. So even though you can tell that I did all of the stories, there's still a different feel and tone and mood to every single one of them. And my art style's changed over the course of 5 years.
Sure. yeah, I would imagine.
And then, yeah. And also, you know, we played around with the way that, you know, Dave sort of scripted these stories too. Like you said, sometimes he would write out a full script with, you know, panels and panel descriptions. Sometimes he would just sort of say, you know, all right, this has to happen on this page. And then he would go in and script it, you know, after.
Yeah, almost Marvel style. Yeah, where.
Yeah, we really like stretched our creative wings and played a lot with this and grew as creators. And, you know, you can see it on in the book, and it's really cool.
Yeah, we've mostly worked with one another. Like, I think the most of the comics work, Chris and I have worked together. I've worked with Chris more than anyone else. I'll put it that way.
Uh-huh.
And so because of that, we're able to play a little bit, like he's saying, and kind of really test the boundaries of, you know, how to script a comic even, you know, so he's right. Like there's places where I'm like, I know it goes here. This is what happens on this page, but you know, do whatever you want with it. And then I go in and sort of dialogue over what he's drawn.
Sure.
So we kind of play back and forth, and that's what I mean about, you know, kind of us working as this tight team where it becomes seamless. Like you don't know who did what at a certain point.
No, I mean, that's very cool. It's cool that, I mean, I would imagine that neither one of you has to be too precious about anything, or like you have to be very sort of collaborative and working on this way and being like very cool with like, if some sort of change is made either in the illustration or the story or the flow of the panels, like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. In fact, that's a great example. The last story that we wrote and drew is called Deep Thirst, and it's sort of a near future pseudo vampire story. It's a little more complicated than that, but
yeah.
But in it, I didn't realize in my script, I had duplicated a page number twice. So there were two page sixes. Now, you're a comics guy, you know, like the real estate is prime and one of them on a comics page. And so you got to be really careful, because especially if we were trying to get this down to 12 pages, because we thought we could print it as a pamphlet, you know, and so we had to have a certain amount of pages. But on top of that, that also you control the page reveals that way. Like the one thing that you have going for you in creating a spooky atmospheric comic is the ability to turn the page, to create suspense so that they have to turn the page and see what's on the next page. If you duplicate a number, now I'm progressing, writing my script, thinking that everything on an odd page is going to be what you turn to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it ruins all the page reveals from anything on. So if I duplicated page six, I'm getting into this is for process fanatics right now. But
well, people love that. Yeah, it helps.
But yeah, if I duplicate page six of a 12-page story, that means everything is off after that.
Yeah.
I can't just extend it by one more page because all my page reveals are off. So Chris came back to me and said, well, there's this sequence in there. Do you really even need this? So he's suddenly editor to me, going like, does this need to be in the story? What does this add to it?
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, you're right. Okay. And so I go back and I remove it, and it fits seamlessly together. And it changes the tones very slightly. And it changed my script very slightly, like my dialogue. And I'm like, this is stronger. This is better than it was before. So that's a great example of like, you know, us kind of working with each other to make sure we're telling the best possible story.
That's very interesting. I kind of like the way that you put that, because in a way, I mean, that's comics, right? It's like the artist and the writer sort of like editing each other's work to sort of like get the best result, you know, if you're working together, right? Particularly, I mean, particularly that sort of like quote unquote Marvel way of working, which is like, you know, an artist. I mean, we've all heard those stories about like Jack Kirby looking at something like that Stan Lee, you know, wrote, and like, no, this, and then a whole page coming back and Stan Lee being like, what? Okay, I'm just going to put this dialogue here and this dialogue here, you know, and basically like reconstruct, or just not even those two, just artists and writers working in comics in general, where it was like, oh, you drew this thing and it kind of made it better, that now I have to, like Chris Claremont, maybe with anyone that he worked with, like on the X-Men or something like that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And in the big publishers, you know, the assembly line style of producing comics, you know, it's to meet deadline demands and printing and publishing demands. And so there's a lot of times you don't get that. But here, because it's just us, we're able to kind of take it back and forth a little more, I think. And not that you can't at the larger publishers, but I think sometimes it just doesn't work out in terms of deadlines and you know, and just the general busyness of it all. We're here, it's like just the two of us and we're producing these ourselves. And so we have a much more of a impetus to like make, to look at it together and make sure that we're on the same page.
No, that's very cool. The one thing that I wanted to mention is out of the framing sequence, the very first one, you did a very good job of like getting my attention in sort of like a Wizard of Oz sort of way, like where it's like the first page. I mean, it opens up on this beautiful illustration of a field, and there's a man, and he's you know, got his horse and his cart. You know, his I forget, I don't know what you would call them, like a little, you know, like in Pinocchio with the traveling, you know, showman sort of thing.
And we call it the puppet wagon.
Yeah, the puppet wagon. That's what I'll call it. Thank you. And, you know, he gets off and he's presenting the story to, you know, the children or whatever. And the whole page is black and white, but there's this little opening where the puppets are and it's color. And you did a very good job of being like, I mean, it just drew my eye to that immediately. And it was evocative to me of that moment where Judy Garland, you know, after the tornado comes out and steps into Oz and is like, what the, you know, and I'm sure as viewers seeing that the first time in a theater, they were just like, what the hell? Like, what happened? I thought this was going to be black and white. So I thought that was like a very cool framing sequence. And I mean, I did like the use of like, I'm assuming this is the correct term, splash colors throughout all of them, because it kind of like adds something different. It draws your eye to it. Was there any planning through the story? I mean, I would imagine there would be, right? Where this is where the color is going to go and this is where the eye is going to be drawn to. Like, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, well, you know, the spot color initially kind of came out. Black, white, and red are traditionally work very well together. Red's always going to draw your eye to something in a black and white illustration. And that's why, you know, it was done in something like, you know, Sin City would do that.
Mm.
And there's other examples of it. And so we did that with, Devil Skin. I think, I don't know if it was the main intention, but at the time we were working on our, another book that we, did together called Lost Angels. Mm-hmm. And I was drawing and coloring all of that, and it was a lot of work. And so we wanted to have something, like David said earlier, to like kind of have it at conventions, and so in order to save me from having to draw and color everything, David's kind of like, well, what if we just spot color it with this red? And so we did that. And then after we loved that book so much that we went on to do, you know, Witchheart after that. And so we just spot colored it green. And that's how we decided to work our way through the entire spectrum with the spot colors. Now, as far as drawing the eye goes, that kind of happens naturally, just the way that I compose a panel when I compose each panel, that sort of, it's sort of Voltron's together how I compose an entire page too. And you know, whenever there's a creepy element coming up, you know it's coming because, you know, that's where the spot color is going to be.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm kind of like scrolling through the PDF right now, and my favorite story in this, and obviously I think they're all really great, but my favorite story in this was the sort of ghost one where the man passes away and he's like, and there was a lot of thoughtfulness to me in that story because I mean, I've never been like suicidal or anything like that, but we've all gone through hard times and stuff. And there had been times when I was very much younger where I've imagined like, you know, people would be like afraid of death and stuff like that. And I would be like, no, it's probably kind of cool. Like, because all the pain is gone and there's no, you don't have to worry about the body anymore. And the aches and pains and all that stuff. And I was just wondering, you know, not to just single out a particular story, but it was my favorite. Like, where did the thinking come for that story? Because it's very much, it's a different sort of thing than you would usually see in a horror story, because usually horror or stuff with Tales from the Crypt and stuff like that is about fear, like being afraid. And this was a bit of a flip to it, where it was like, oh, this is a bit more peaceful, more up until you sort of get to like what ends up driving the antagonist in the story, because something does happen. But up until that point, to me, it was just kind of funny, almost like a defending your life sort of thing, where it was like, hey, this isn't that bad. It's not something to be afraid of. Can you talk to the space that that story might have come from?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a middle-aged guy feeling pain. And it's exactly what you said. It's sort of like this sort of meditation. This one actually began, I wrote, I think, maybe two pages as a short prose story.
Sure.
It just sort of one of the, sometimes you think of a line or whatever, and you're like, oh, I think that's what I'm going to write, you know, and I follow it a bit. But then at a certain point, and I don't remember the exact moment it happened, but I was kind of like, wait a minute, this actually could be a comic, and this could actually fit into our, we were calling them one-shot horror at the time. And we had maybe done maybe the first three at the time I started writing this. And so I don't think we had done Dollhouse yet, and I started writing this prose thing. And then maybe we did Dollhouse, and then maybe I'm like, you know what? I never finished that story. Maybe I could finish it if I write it for Chris. But to your original point, it definitely came from a place where I'm like, you know, I'm afraid of dying. I'm reaching a certain age where I, you know, there's a certain way that you get to a certain point and you're like, this is where you have a fatal heart attack, you know, if you're not taking care of yourself. And not that I am, in, by the way, I'm not in danger of that or anything, but that's a fear that comes up. And also as you age, you feel all the pains and aches and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
So there got to a point where I'm like, you know what? I'm totally afraid of dying. But I think once that was over, it would actually be kind of nice because, you know, if your consciousness continued to exist. So the story really sprang from that, like, okay. And so he goes through that, and I don't want to give away the whole thing, but yeah, there's a twist to it that brings a bit of the fear back. And it's not even fear so much in this one. I think the fear ends at the beginning of the story, and then it's more of, wait, what do I want to do next with what I've been given? And it is about him, you know, finding a way to do things on his own terms and maybe come to terms with what he's missed and all that kind of stuff. So it's funny. You're right. It is a more melancholy story. And maybe that's why we chose blue. It's sort of ethereal and ghostly. But also it felt kind of a little melancholy. It felt like the mood of the story a bit. And so that's where it came from, at least from the story side.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, it was, and also wonderfully illustrated. I mean, they all are, but there was definitely something about this that I just like the main character design. You know, I love the sort of like interaction, like him going through the city and just really, I don't know, for some reason, as odd as it is to say about a horror book, I found that like very fun, like a very fun chapter.
Oh, good.
You know what's really funny too is that you say that, because I'm really proud of that story. The especially the sort of the mundane scenes of that story, the first few pages. I redrew that story, I think, three times.
No way.
Yeah, I did.
You and I are alike then.
I have. Well, I and this is a funny thing, is I never do that. I'm always.
Oh, really?
Moving. Never. Never. Never.
Really.
Move forward. Keep going forward. You can do. You can perfect the next page.
Just so much more secure going. A person comedy, than I am. But, yeah.
I'm just like deadlines, you know. But yeah. But I sort of like when I started drawing this, I was going through a huge like Alex Toth studying phase, and I was like, I really need to simplify this. I really need to make this as clear as possible. So I was just going to kind of use like a dead pen with no line width to it whatsoever.
Oh, interesting.
And I drew the first three or four pages of it, maybe even more actually. But I got really good composition that I liked from it. But then I was like, but this doesn't look like me. And I'm trying to be something that I'm not. And it's not going to work. So I was like, I'm going to try it a little bit differently. But I still want, I originally started drawing this on smaller paper. I think it was like 9x12, and then you got to make it even smaller so it's the right dimension. And so I started to do it again, and I did it with ink wash and make it a little bit more detailed, a little bit more me, but it still wasn't quite there. It still wasn't me. And I was like, this isn't going to fly. This is not going to fly for me. So I said, the heck with it. And I just went back to my big paper. But now by the time that I went to my 11x17 paper that I normally draw on, I knew these pages, and yeah. I was able to tweak any little other thing that, you know, get rid of. And in a way, the funny thing is like the whole thing with Toth is you get rid of anything that doesn't need to be there at all, you know? And by the time I got to the final version of it, it was really the most like clear vision of, you know, that I could possibly put on the page. And the funny thing is it's like supposed to be just these mundane everyday things. Like there's a cat sniffing a stain, or there's like him going to grab like a box of cat food and his hand goes through it. And then there's a scene of an empty office where people are throwing away his stuff because he's dead now. And, you know, or like a shopping mall sign. And that's it. That's all that's on the page. But I'm like that page in particular, I was like super proud of.
And by the way, I don't think most of that stuff that he's talking about, those beats, were scripted. I think I said this is the kind of thing that, this is one of those scripts where I think, right, Chris, that I kind of said this is the kind of thing that happens, or this is the dialogue that, or the captions that are running through it. Found the imagery to go with it.
Right.
I think that's how we did that one.
Yeah, I wanted to counter the imagery because, you know, it's like say it and not show it kind of thing. And so you were already saying what was going on. So I had to counterpoint what you were saying with a different kind of image that also was showing that.
Yeah. Just looking at the story, and this is going to seem like an odd question, the main character, and not to just focus on one of the stories because I like them all, but as I said, this one kind of stuck out to me. As far as the design of that character, I'm looking at his face on the first page, and is there like a Casper influence, like a ghost? Because it is a ghost. It looks a little like his eyes are like almost the shape of like cat, and his head is like, you know, it's kind of like a roundish, pointed sort of. And I was just wondering, was there any cartoon sort of influence to the design of that character, or did it sneak in there subconsciously?
No, it's probably subconsciously. The blue probably helps you think that too.
Yeah.
The funny thing is like I was just flipping through Kyle Baker's Cowboy Wally book, and that's where the cartooniness probably comes from. Actually, I designed him before that, even though. So no Casper, but I can see what you're talking about. I just needed to pay, like have somebody who, you know, would look like they were winded if they tried to go up.
I think from the story side, that was my only direction, was that this has got to be like kind of this middle-aged guy who's overweight, who lives a very small life.
Yeah.
You know, very like he's got his cat and his therapist and an office job, and he doesn't, and that's, and then he just goes from one to the other, because that's sort of the other part of this melancholy, is that like he lived a very small life because he was afraid of everything, and then he died. And then he had nothing to be afraid of anymore.
It's interesting to kind of like, I can't talk about it without spoiling it, but like the sort of, there's a message in the beginning and then it goes to a place. And I was like, but wait, is this kind of the message that you want to live in? And then it flips again. It is very well done. I mean, I very much enjoyed it. I was like, okay, this is very cool. I liked all of the stories. Let me ask you another question, because you were talking both about making this like a small, originally with your first story, the devil story, correct? That this was just going to be like a one-off sort of like short story, and you would sell it at conventions, and you know, that that was that. But at what point do you sort of get where you're like, hey, wait, I got another story. Oh, wait, there's another one. Like, and you're working together. And instead of just like a short, like little one-off book, you know, it becomes like a big anthology, like, and that's sort of like a different task to take on, right? Or was it just like, let's just keep going, we're having fun.
For sure.
And then on top of that, at what point did you both have to say like, look, enough stories right now. We need to cap it off.
Personally, I want to say that I think maybe even as early as, so the first one was Devil Skin. The second story we created was Witch Heart. And we produced each of these as like small batch self-published print runs that we would bring to conventions. And I want to say even as, and Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we were even started talking about, boy, if we do enough of these, we'll have a book, even as early as that point.
Like, okay.
Even as early as the second one. I know definitely by the time we did our third one, Wolf Moon, came out of us being at conventions with the first two and me noticing how much medieval fantasy was in play at conventions.
Oh.
And I said, we need to do another one. I need to bring medieval fantasy. Because like Chris would have people come to him wanting a commission of their Dungeons and Dragons character drawn. And you'd see a lot of people cosplaying as their D&D character. And so we were like, you know, there's something here. And I immediately thought of werewolves and fantasy. And so that one was kind of engineered almost out of that. It's like, oh, there's something here that's appealing. And then I had to find a story in that. But I think by the time we had those three, we were really talking about if we do enough of these, we'll have to collect them. Then that was cut short by the pandemic where Chris said, hey, we're not having any conventions right now. What if we do an Instagram comic for the next one? And then I said, well, we can do that, but I need to be able to assemble it into a 12-page comic afterwards. And I'm thinking, A, that we could bring that to shows as another one shot. But I'm also really thinking at that point, like, oh, I think we're both talking about it, you know, of like, and it will be a story in the volume.
Gotcha.
Is that right, Chris? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Nice.
Exactly.
Nice. So I would imagine that you're both horror fans.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Creating this. So wait, Chris, you would say you were working on Creepshow as?
Yeah, I worked on Creepshow, the comic.
With
Greg Nicotero before the show came out. So we did a signing of that. It was a very limited run, like an issue zero. We did a signing together at Comic-Con. Before the show came out, and then I worked on the show as well for like the transition scenes, the comic art that turns into the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on that as well for the first season.
Oh, cool!
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. That's great. That's great. So, what are some of your favorite horror things? Like, what do you both love as far as like horror movies, or like what are some of your favorites, or what inspired you? You had said like Tales from the Crypt, but there must be like a favorite movie that you just go to that you're like, this is my favorite, like this is the best. Can you pick, or is the genre too precious to just pick one?
No, I don't know. I mean, it's always hard to pick one, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
picking a favorite is, you know, it's like saying your favorite color. Why do I have to have one favorite color? But I don't know. Dave, what's your favorite horror movie?
I don't know if I have a singular favorite. I usually go toward the like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and those. Mm. I like supernatural horror movies.
Sure.
So I'm a big fan of those. I wrote in my dedication to this book, I actually dedicated it to John Carpenter and Stephen King.
Because
for me, my childhood, my teenage years, as I kind of moved from really loving like fantasy as a kid, like The Hobbit and stuff, into like kind of discovering horror as an early teenager, it was really the movies of John Carpenter and the books of Stephen King that just, I think, informed so much of you know, what I would come to love in horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What about you, Chris? Anything that sticks out or?
Yeah, probably. My go-to is usually Return of the Living Dead.
Mm.
I think it's just absolutely perfect, and in its schlockiness and its ridiculousness, and the design of the Tar Man is like just one of the greatest zombie designs of all time.
Yeah.
The way that he moves, just so creepy. And you know, Nosferatu and the silent horror films always really did it for me in setting a tone. And so I think I'm really drawn to those kinds of things.
Nice. I've been waiting all my life to see Nosferatu because you can see it on Netflix. You can see it on anything, but I've been wanting to see it on the big screen because silent film, I will fall asleep on the couch, not because it's boring, because it's like sort of like the end of my day. And I'm just like sitting there and I'm reading the screen and then I just start to doze. But the design, just, I still haven't seen Metropolis, like these movies I should have seen by now at my age, and because I want to see them on the big screen.
Yeah.
And unfortunately I live in the San Fernando Valley and there's no like big revival theaters. Although there should be, somebody should have, maybe I'll do that. I don't know.
That's funny you say that, because the last movie that I saw before everything shut down for quarantine was Nosferatu. At the Secret Movie Club here in it was in Los Feliz.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, it does pop up every, especially during Halloween. And, you know, it's 100th anniversary of that movie right now.
Oh, really? This year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. And so I'm pretty sure it was just like a couple of days ago, I think. I'm pretty sure that they're probably going to be popping up, especially during Halloween in Los Angeles. You can bet.
Yeah,
there's
going
to be some place where you can go and see it, and they're going to have a live organist, or they're going to have just some great soundtrack.
Yeah, so. I'm going to have to track it down. The problem for the past several years is like that Halloween is sort of like one of those holidays where parents, it's like, yep, I got to focus on the kids having a good time and all that. So I'm not able to like pull myself away like on actual Halloween. Like it's always like on Halloween and I'm like, really? Can you do it the night before or like a week before so I can go see this damn thing finally on the
Hopefully
big screen?
I'll do that for you. Yeah.
But we'll
my best experience with Nosferatu, I actually saw this is, and this probably dates me, this is going to date me, but this goes back to the 90s. In San Francisco.
You saw it in its first run, right?
Yeah, I saw it in its first run. I am undead. No, it's about me. No, I saw three black and white silent films, each with a different live score performed in San Francisco in the 90s, I want to say this was. And Nosferatu, I believe, had a like an orchestra, orchestral score. And then there was the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that had like this jazz trio score. And then Haxan, the witchcraft movie.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with. There was a woman there who did everything like with a vocal recorder where she could manipulate her own voice. And it was this weird, and she would make these weird sort of throat sounds and scritchy, scratchy sounds and stuff, and scored the entire movie of Haxan that way. And so, you know, those probably had an impact on me. I remember them to this day. And, you know, I'm sure that some elements of that seep into in the atmosphere that we try to create in these stories for this book.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, it's interesting to me, too. And you mentioned The Exorcist, and like every October for the past several years, we've done like each week in October, we've done episodes on like we pick a horror movie. And we talk about that horror movie, like during, and, you know, my friends and I will get on, or I'll get creators to come on and they'll pick a horror movie and we'll just chat about that movie. And I don't think it was last year, maybe the year before. The Exorcist is one of my favorites of all time, just because I grew up Catholic and I'm not practicing these days, but it's one of those things. And I have a little sister. Like all somebody had to do was tell me about The Exorcist, literally. And I was walking a wide berth around my sister's room, like down the hallway. I just didn't even want to like go near it. But it's interesting to me how horror develops over the years. And the thing that I realized now as an adult with a family and a daughter of my own, how The Exorcist and particularly not being religious at all. So not necessarily being afraid of something like Satan or something, the devil or anything, or possession. I mentioned this on a podcast a couple of weeks ago. I'm very much a Scully as opposed to a Mulder. I'm like, you have to show me. I need to see it. I'm not just going to believe in the thing. But my point being is when we were talking about The Exorcist, the thing that I realized is that I it's still scary to me and it's still very messed up. But to me, the horror is a different place where it's more about, as a parent, I identified more with the mother at this point, where it was like, the horror of being a parent and having a child and something is wrong with that child and there is absolutely nothing in my power I can do. So it was almost like an analogy to like cancer or something like that, where I was very much like, holy cow, this plays on like so many different levels. Can you talk a little bit about how your storytelling may have developed through the years and how that affects this current project? Because David, you have said, and you know, I'm not calling out your age or anything, you're like dating yourself. And you know, you said there's a middle-aged character. How does horror play to you now, viewing it through a lens of an older person or even people who have worked in the industry and created your own stories?
Yeah. I'm very aware, and I didn't make this up. A friend of mine actually said this to me, and I don't know where he got it from. But I feel that this is very relevant, and I think about it a lot, that children's horror is the monster in the closet.
Yeah.
Teen horror is the slasher out to get you when you're breaking the rules, when you're doing something you're not supposed to. Middle age horror is body horror. It's about your body changing in the or falling apart or all this kind of stuff. And I feel like that to me fits a lot of how I still think about horror today. You know, it's funny because you mentioned watching The Exorcist as a parent, and I've done that as well.
Yeah.
I just recently rewatched Poltergeist for its like 40th anniversary. I was on a podcast talking about it.
Nice.
And I had the same thing. I'm like, you know, I am Robbie's age, or, you know, at that age that the movie came out. I am that kid. I have all those toys. My bedroom looks like his.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it, and it was kind of like the first scary movie I saw. And then, like, I remember thinking, like, you know, and the effects, like the guy ripping his face off in the bathroom, you know, it's like the thing I remember. Watching it now, I'm so fascinated by Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams.
Yeah.
Right? I can't remember their names now in the show, but Steve and Diane, I think they are.
Yeah.
And I was so much more fascinated by their take on it and what they're doing and how they're trying to cope with it. So to your point, yes, I think I relate to the great stories and the great films in different ways as a child and as an adult.
Yeah.
However, in terms of my own storytelling, yeah, I think it's a bit of, I think I'm closer now to what scares me. I'm more reflective and contemplative about, you know, this is where this fear comes from. This is why I'm having it. You know, whether it's me reminiscing about a childhood fear and maybe where that came from or whatever, but I think a lot about how we're all wired and particularly how I'm wired. And I try to find the fear in that, you know, and then what can I play to with that?
Yeah.
So for me, I think it's more of an awareness of self that allows me to tap into fear a little more concretely than I would have been able to as a younger writer.
Sure, sure. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, I haven't really thought about it. To be honest with you.
That's funny.
I don't know. How has it developed? I don't know. I'm always thinking about the tone and the atmosphere, and that's just always the way it's been for me.
Sure.
It hasn't evolved much since that first time I was, you know, 6 years old and saw Nosferatu.
Yeah.
You know, as long as the tone is right.
But you definitely bring that feeling into a lot of the stories. Nosferatu plays a lot in Dollhouse. It also plays a little bit in Deep Thirst. It plays in a lot of our stories in different ways.
Well, what's interesting to me and also the art is how mature the stories seem. And I don't mean mature as in old or like old fashioned or anything like that. They just seem like they play on different levels, you know? And to what David was speaking to earlier, a little, you know, a second ago, it also doesn't help that the world has kind of, I mean, when I grew up in the 80s, I was terrified of a plague and zombies and stuff. That was my thing. Like, and I still love zombies. Mm-hmm. I mean, zombies are my jam. I just saw a trailer for like the Netflix. They're doing a Resident Evil TV show. And I was like, I'm there. I don't like, I'm not a big fan of like all the movies. I kind of like the first one. I don't know if that makes people disrespect me or respect me. I don't know, but I did like the first Mila Jovovich one. I didn't know she was going to do 20 of them, people. I just liked the first one. But like the idea of a plague and stuff like that just freaked me out, or nuclear war and stuff. And with what has happened in the past 2 years. And that's the thing I always say to my wife is like, I turn her, I was like, you don't understand. As bad as it's been, and I agree that it's been, it could have been so much worse. like we could have. So I mean, just that the world outside has caught up with us. And as we get older, I mean, we see things that I never thought I would have imagined seeing growing up when I did, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny, Christian, you mentioned The Exorcist, and I'm going to bring that back again. You may or may not know this, but before I did these comics with Chris, I had done an audio drama, a podcast called Wormwood.
Oh,
and the main character is a famed psychiatrist who experiences basically what the priest in The Exorcist faces. Like, he faces a possession.
Mm.
And so when you were talking about how your fear of it as a kid and as an adult changed, I think that for me, it was sort of like, I always felt like The Exorcist is scarier if you're an atheist. If you think you understand how everything, how science works, how the mind works, then to run up against actual demons undoes your whole world. And so that he becomes a central character in this show, Wormwood, which is, he's like sort of he was a famed psychiatrist, and now he's sort of a washed up exorcist trying to like, and he's a broken man because of what he understood. And I think that it wasn't until a few years later, a therapist is talking to me and says, so you wrote this character whose whole world gets shattered and the whole, all the rules change. And this happened like right as you were getting divorced. Is that right?
Okay. Oh, wow.
So that's when I talk about awareness and the evolution of, and the maturity of storytelling or whatever, you know, that was like a, whoa, oh my God. So I'm writing about a guy who can't understand the world he's in anymore because he thought it was one thing and suddenly it busts out into something much larger. And I think that is, I don't know where I'm going with that other than to say, I think that's a big key, big cornerstone of how I approach horror.
Oh, nice. Nice. For me, one of the things as a cynical adult now is what would it take for me? Because again, I'm a fan of horror. I love like horror movies and stuff like that. And for me is what would it take for me to be like, to believe, you know, barrier would have to break? Like I could see the head spinning around and be like, ah, that's just some kind of spasm or like, you know what I mean? Or lifting off the bed. I'd be like, I don't know, something like I would need the need to explain it sort of like kicks in. And I'm a fan of all this stuff. I mean, I can see Chris's office and I've got you beat. Like if I had my camera on, like I've got like all this stuff. So I'm like a huge fan of this thing, but it's funny how I've gotten older that to me, like I believe less. And I've always wondered, and I don't know, is there a horror movie out there where it's just like, or a story to your point, David, and I would love to hear the podcast if you could send me the link to that, because that sounds amazing. But to me, it's like, what, I don't know that I've ever seen in a movie somebody that's just like, okay, like I'm not in, like I don't, and then they start to believe, like where the, cause for me, I don't know what it would be. What would it be where I'd be like, this is an actual demon, like, right?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Does that
and
exist?
And that was my premise. Like, yeah, if you met that incontrovertible proof,
yeah,
you know, it would shatter your whole world.
Gotcha.
Cause now you're like, okay, is there's a hell, there's a heaven, there's a, you know, like, and maybe you're, if you're somebody who doesn't believe in any of that stuff, to me, that would be like, that'd be like the scariest thing possible.
Absolutely.
Right? Because it takes everything, the way you've lived your life, whatever, is called into question. So yeah.
Sure. Yeah. 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 So are you both kind of making more Spectral as this goes on? Are there plans for more horror stories or like little comics that you're going to sell at conventions, or does it wrap up with this, or will there be a second volume after this? Or I can't imagine that you're stopping, right?
We're not stopping making comics.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But little short comics or?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be an immediate jump into a sequel to Spectral, but I know, Dave, you said that you have ideas. I know you have ideas, actually, for keeping it going. And should we be successful, knock on wood, with this? It's looking good.
That's good.
The campaign's looking good.
Hopefully this helps.
Yes. There will probably be more, because the beauty of this project is that, you know, it's not, we don't have a deadline for it. It's not an immediate thing. It's 12 pages, something that I can, you know, I can put out, you know, while also working on another book at the same time. Mm. And yeah, we have other pitches and other ideas for stuff that we want to get out there to publishers and hopefully, you know, continue our teamwork that we've got going together. So
yeah, I think we obviously like working together a lot, right?
Yeah, right.
and I think that we both have ideas, because I think one thing that Spectral, putting it together in a book, and it is complete in this volume, but we do introduce this puppeteer character of Professor mm-hmm. Spectral, and so my imagination is alight now with, well, we lay out there's a lot of mystery around this character. And he's got his own story to tell. And I would like to get to that story. And I think that, so it makes it a little bit more than like a crypt keeper kind of host, but he actually has his own story. And I'd love to dig into that. But to Chris's point, there's also so many other creatures and monsters out there that there's no shortage of sort of colors and creatures we can match together and continue these. And I think, again, as Chris mentioned, the Kickstarter is a big test for us. Like, can we find our audience and take it directly to them with Kickstarter? If this is successful, it opens up the doors. We could do another project, and it may be a Spectral Volume 2. It may be one of our other pitches that we've been working on. I would like to use Kickstarter as sort of a way to sort of bypass a lot of the middle gatekeeping kind of stuff and just bring stuff directly to to readers, you know, and, but that's assuming that they want it, and we can reach enough. And so we have to succeed in this Kickstarter,
sure.
But there's a lot of potential here. And, you know, as Chris alluded to, we have like, I want to say 3 or 4 pitches that are out to publishers. And so we're always working together and we're always trying to come up with new concepts, but, you know, so there, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what we do next. But definitely there is more Spectral ideas brewing for more Spectral, nice. But this is not a cliffhanger. So I just want to be clear on that. If you get this, you're not going to be like, well, what happens next?
I mean, yeah. But they're self-contained stories.
But it is complete. It is contained. Yeah.
Yeah. And Chris, I just want to say, one of the first pages, you have that very beautiful brush, design of the puppeteers, his head and the boat and the tie and everything. I love that drawing. It's
oh, you do? Yeah. I think I'm going to put that up as a reward tier pretty soon here.
That's cool. Yeah.
Like
just the head? Are you talking about just the head?
Yeah. It's just the head sketch. Yep. The head.
That's I think the first drawing I did of him. And so that was kind of sealed it. So yeah, I think I'm going to put that up. And so hopefully somebody will.
That's great. No, I think that's great. It's really, really very nicely done. I like the design a lot. Well, very much like this book, Spectral. I love horror. Spectral, A Showcase of Fear, currently on Kickstarter. Any final words for anyone or anything that anyone should know that we haven't covered as far as like the project itself?
I mean, if you like pins, if you like bundles of other crazy books, if you like puppets, if you like original art, we've got all of that stuff for you. So come check out our creepy little Kickstarter and back it now. Don't wait.
Don't wait.
Yeah.
Do
hopefully
it now.
We've made our case that this book is special and something very unique that people should go. But we did, as Chris said, we did try to make the reward tiers as exciting as we possibly could. So there's everything from enamel pins to those one of a kind Muppet puppets to bundles of books. We worked with one of my other publishers, Fanbase Press, offered us a couple of their books. So there's a digital bundle that has Spectral and The Margins, which is a book that I co-wrote for them. And then and then two of their other books that kind of fit in the same sort of Twilight Zone-y kind of frame of reference. And so we felt those fit. And so we made a bundle of all those digital comics, like over 400 pages, you know, just as an example of different things you could get if you're a comics fan and you're interested. So,
and I just put a couple commissions up too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, he opened it up for a couple commissions, very limited, but I think already a couple of them went, right?
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as well they should. Yeah.
And have Chris draw Press, whatever you want him to.
Yeah. And you were saying Fanbase Press, they do great stuff. So that's terrific too.
Yes, absolutely. Nice.
Great. Well, and where can people find you online? Is it the Twitters? Is it the Instagrams? Is it the Facebooks, the Book of Face? Where can people locate you if they want to find out more about you individually or as a group or however you want to be found?
I'm Chris is on Instagram at Chris Anderson Comics, and Twitter at Chris A Comics. You can find my website at chrisandersoncomics.com also.
Nice.
Yeah, and I am on Twitter and Instagram. I am D Acampo, so D-A-C-C-A-M-P-O. And then I'm on Facebook. You can find me by name if you would like to. And I am all, you can also visit my website at davidacampo.com. And I do have links there directly to the Kickstarter, although I'm sure you're going to post that stuff as well.
But
the key is to get everyone to the Kickstarter, but yeah, you can find us on social and we are pimping our Kickstarter like crazy right now. So we're all over the social media doing that.
As you should. Yeah.
And speaking of pimping, I always forget to pimp my Patreon. I have a Patreon too.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Patreon at Chris Anderson Comics. Yeah.
Nice. That's excellent.
And he occasionally sends out to his list, to his people, some his fans like me, little self-made printed comics that are kind of like awesome little things. So it's definitely worth your while.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome. Well, that's great. Well, the project is called Spectral and A Showcase of Fear. I love that. Spectral. It is currently on Kickstarter. Go to Kickstarter and search for Spectral. It will be there. There's all kinds of great stuff. I mean, puppets. You're giving away puppets. I mean, not giving them away, but like that's great. I have had David Acampo, Chris Anderson. The project is called Spectral. My name is Christian Horn. This has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. Go support Spectral on Kickstarter, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye. Part-Time Fanboy.